call to order this hearing of the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight for Wednesday, March 17th. We have the first item is our approval of our minutes. We have the minutes, first of all, of Wednesday, let's see, March 10th, our 3 o'clock hearing. Would people look that over, see if there are any corrections to be made? Any corrections? Senator Carlson moves adoption and approval of the minutes of March 10th, the 3 o'clock hearing. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Then we have the minutes from the 6 p.m. hearing. It was a separate hearing. We were not at recess.
I see what happened.
Are there corrections to those minutes?
Oh.
Are we all settled now?
We're sort of confused.
Senator Carlson moves approval of the March 10th, 6 p.m. hearing. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendments are approved as written. We have the minutes from the March 12th hearing at 10 a.m., the Friday hearing. Any corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves approval of the March 12th minutes as presented. All in favor of those motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And then we have the minutes from March 15th, the 3 o'clock hearing. Are there any corrections to that, to those minutes? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves approval of the minutes from March 15th, the 3 o'clock hearing. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved as presented. Senator Cole. First bill on our agenda today is 2698. If the bill is acted on favorably, it goes to the Finance Committee. Senator Cole.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members, and happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone. You have before you Senate File 2698. This is an education bill on the grad test, and I am before your committee today to deal with Section 2, which is it's not an exemption from rulemaking, but it's an expedited rulemaking for MDE to make the changes required for this legislation. Madam Chair, would you like an explanation of the bill or...
I want the members to be clear what exempt rulemaking authority means. Okay.
So, and let me, I've got this from the Department of Education. The reviser included a provision in the bill instructing the Minnesota Department of Education to amend Minnesota Rule 3501.1120 to conform to the new language under the good cause exemption. The changes in the statute will make the current language in the rule obsolete, so the rules simply need to be updated to reflect this change. The change is allowing, instead of a 6-week testing schedule for seniors, it would move it up to a 4-week testing schedule for seniors in high school for the reading grad portion. And then MDE goes on to say, we believe this would be a technical update to a very short rule and not much involve much time or cost. The amended fiscal note will detail the actual cost, but we would expect it to be relatively minimal. And I have also a copy of the strikeouts and underlining of the rule if members would like that.
Okay, and so what the department is asking for is to be exempt from going through rules in order to change the rules and simply allowing them to do it because they, quote, have this good cause exemption. Okay. We see this on occasion, but I think it's important for members to understand it. Is there, Senator Roebling, any question or comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll move the bill when it's appropriate. But it is
is a, I think it is a good idea because we are approaching deadlines for some seniors who need another opportunity sooner rather than later. And also, if they don't have to go through the full rulemaking process, the cost will be considerably less and much more expedient.
They don't
expedient.
Have to go through it at all. They can just change it, is what the as far as I understand. What it,
that's as I understand it as well.
Because it is so minor. Any questions? Anybody in the audience want to comment on the item in the jurisdiction of this committee? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate file 2698, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Committee.
Senator Polk, I'm going to go to Senator Phoebe now, and then we'll come back to Senator Bonhoeffer. Senator Phoebe brings us Senate File 1682.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I believe this is my first time in front of your committee. So
aren't you lucky?
Nice to be here today. I think it's cool, nice to be here today. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I kind of forgot that this morning. I'm here,
you
yes.
You have a good co-author here, I know.
Yes, I have a wonderful co-author, Madam Chair. I would first like to offer the A-10 amendment.
This is the Committee of Origin, so this is an author's amendment. Senator Pappas moves the A-10 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas?
Since we've already drafted the amendment, was it in our packet? Okay, I didn't dig down high enough, far enough.
It was in
okay.
mine.
Thank
I
you.
Think it was, yep. it was in there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Senator Phoebe, you want to explain your bill now?
Yes, and simply the amendment just changes the effective date. So more on the bill, Madam Chair, is this is a very straightforward, good government bill with our increasingly difficult budget situation. Whenever we can identify areas of unnecessary government spending, we should try to move toward eliminating it. While this bill obviously certainly doesn't take care of all of our problems, it helps get us moving in the right direction a bit. This bill is an extension of the Revisor's Office's recent efforts to reduce publication costs for our state statute books. By conducting a simple survey of those receiving free state statute books, there will be fewer books printed, potentially, which will reduce costs and lessen environmental impacts. Senate File 1682 will require the Revisor's Office to do a survey of all those which receive free copies of the state statute books. This survey must use an opt-in approach. If a recipient responds yes, a free set will be printed and sent to them. If there is a no response or a non-response, the free set printed will not be printed. Currently, of the 3,200 sets printed, approximately 1,600 are free sets under the statute. The free sets are split between the courts, libraries, legislature, and the executive branch. The Revisor's Office estimates a nearly $10,000 reduction for every 100 set of statutes not printed. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. And someone
is Timmons
first
here?
I don't see her yet. So.
We understand maybe she thought she was going later in the hearing, but we're dealing with it now. But I think you clearly indicated what the fully explain what the bill is. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm glad you have this bill. I always wonder why we need legislation to do this. And I've been frustrated over the years when, I mean, like with the Senate's own practices for the Senate journals, the Bowen journals, they would distribute them every year, whether we want them or not. And I always asked our suite to keep them wrapped up in cellophane to see if anybody ever used them, and nobody ever needed them. Mm-hmm. And I've tried many times to encourage some of those offices to not produce the books they don't need. Why do we need to do this legislatively? I mean, the Revisor's Office, I know they're legally required to provide free copies, but if people don't want them, do they feel they have to do it anyway?
I think it's a matter of printing them if they have, isn't it?
Well, Madam Chair, but if I mean, what they're going to do is a survey. Now, if they asked each of us, do we really want a set for our offices since it's available online? I think they could save the money and not print them. I'm glad you're doing this. I just wonder why they can't do it on their own. But I hope the Secretary of the Senate
session,
does
it's
the
session
same
law,
thing.
Obviously. It's not changing a statute. But apparently the reviser thinks she needs
I'll move
legislative
the
authority. Is there further questions for Senator Phoebe? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1682, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Thank you very
Chair
much, Senator
Phoebe.
Senator Bonoff, I think you're in the room. We'll take your bill next. Senator Bonoff has Senate File 3002. Senator Bonoff, I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, I have the A1 amendment.
Okay, this is
not
the
delete
committee
off.
Of original jurisdiction. So I'll ask someone to offer the amendment, but then we will ask you to explain it before we take action on it. So Senator Sieben moves the A1 amendment. Senator Bonoff, would you explain what you have done in this amendment that's different from the bill, since it is a delete everything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The intent of the bill, the membership of the task force, nothing has been changed in the A1 amendment. This task force, just matter of record, is a task force on school desegregation and integration. We have a subcommittee through the Education Committee assigned to look at and consider whether or not we ought to change the way we deliver integration aid. Actually, Senator Roebling's on that subcommittee, I believe. But this bill says that during the interim, there will be a task force of people who participate with this program to evaluate and recommend how we might reform our desegregation and integration aid program. The way that the bill was passed in education did not conform to the standards that this committee uses when looking at task force legislation. So this A1 amendment simply makes sure that the language in the bill reflects the high standards that this committee expects from task force legislation.
Okay, so there's the just reworded some of the ways in which people would be selected or who the appointees would be, particularly from the legislature. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. For example, instead of specifying a suburban, rural district, we said a balance of geographic areas, things like that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there questions of Senator Bonoff with regard to the delete everything amendment and this bill, since it does have legislators on it? If we act favorably on it, goes to the Rules Committee.
Yes.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Page 2, lines 26 on the task force shall submit to the legislative committees and divisions. So are that all the members of it, or just the chairs and the ranking minority members?
Where are you? What is the
page
line?
2, line 26.
Madam Chair.
Did you want that to the chairs and ranking members, Senator Bonoff, or did you really want it to go to every member of the committee?
Madam Chair, to the ranking member.
The chairs and the ranking members?
Yes.
Senator Sieben, would you incorporate that language in your amendment? So it would be on 226, the task force shall submit to the chairs and ranking members, minority members of the legislative committees and divisions with jurisdiction over, et cetera. Any other questions on the amendment? Senator Roebling, did you have a question?
Not on the amendment.
No. Okay, we have Senator Sieben's amendment before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 That's okay, Madam Chair.
Okay, can we?
We just voted on the A1 amendment, right?
Okay. All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And so we have the bill before us, Senate File 3002. Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, I actually believe that I did speak about the bill, but I just, in summary, and it sounds like Senator Gerlach has a question, that we do think that it's time we change the way we do integration aid. And as the committee might recall, the legislative auditor did a report on that in 2005, and we have not taken action as the legislature consistent with the findings and the recommendations of the legislative auditor's report. One of the things that we think is paramount before we can address this is to actually go back and understand the DSEG rule, the history of it, what came of that. And so before the legislative session is over, this session, we'll be taking time in our subcommittee to do that. However, there was a lot of concern around the community that we were going to be recommending policies and legislation that would have significant effects on communities and programs that we may not have a thorough understanding of. So this bill was brought forward from that community to say, could we please make sure there's a formal process for us to give our input? So while we won't necessarily have to adopt every recommended policy change, I think this is a wonderful opportunity for this group to come together and be part of revamping this program.
Senator Gerlach, question or comment?
Madam Chair, this is one of the issues recurring, and I probably missed some of these and some previous ones have gone through, but and this has to do with the recurring issue of the appointment. Is it the majority and the minority leaders, or is it the subcommittee, which of course is the majority party decides, and this sort of thing? And we've had some talk about that. But I notice in section 4, lines on 19 through 22, the language of the bill says two members of the House of Representatives, including one member of the majority party, one from the minority party, appointed by the speaker. It says in consultation with the minority leader. That language is missing on the Senate side. If we look in the Senate portion here on lines 27 through 30, it says two members from the Senate, including one member of the majority, one of the minority, appointed by the subcommittee on committees. And it says
Senator Gerlach, the reason there is this, both the majority leader and the Senate minority leader serve on the subcommittee on committees.
Okay.
And the reason why I visited with Senator Bonhoff earlier today, we didn't want to be or thinking about it, since it's two people and one has to be from the generally outside the metropolitan area and outside regional centers, and one has to be from within. We didn't want it to be, well, the Democrats pick the big district one and the Republicans choose the other district, or vice versa, and that by requiring consultation in the House, which they otherwise wouldn't have to do, but on the subcommittee, on committees in the Senate, they necessarily would because they both sit on it. That would
suggest. Okay, so there's a little twist to this one. It's a little different than some of the others
because
of the geographic.
I mean, if it had been, you know, four members, two each, you wouldn't have to have this kind of.
Okay, Madam Chair, that answers my question then.
Okay. Any other discussion? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, do you envision this task force doing some of the research on the programs again, something like the Legislative Auditors Audit Commission did 5 years ago, to see what the uses of the money are? Because I do have some concerns, and I'm glad we're looking at it again, and we have been looking at it, but there really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of oversight of this program at the Department of Education. And there's multiple uses for the money. And I've often questioned the program at all. I've wondered, and I'm a little concerned that, you look like you have a lot of advocates on this task force. And I'm wondering if all the recommendations will come out and say, oh, it's a great program and we have to continue it, or will somebody in this group that you have chosen to be on the task force perhaps say, this isn't working, the whole thing should be thrown out? I'm just looking at the makeup of the task force members. I'm concerned that wouldn't even be a possibility. I'm not certain, but it does concern me a little bit.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Senator Roebling, I think one of the reasons why the advocates brought this forward is because they were concerned with me being chair of the subcommittee. I might go in a direction more similar to where you're going, because I too have questioned greatly the need for this program, given the diversity that does exist in all of our districts today, that wouldn't we be better to direct the money towards making sure we close the achievement gap, and particularly with regard to concentrations of poverty. Having said that, I want to be open-minded to the many experts that have worked in this area that feel very strongly. And so I would hope that the Committee on Committees appoints me, and perhaps you could talk to the minority leader and have him point you, because we are both on that subcommittee, and I think that we ought to have a seat on the table. However, at the end of the day, it will be legislators proposing legislation. So we'll be informed by the work of the subcommittee, or work of this task force, but we will have to make a choice. Do we accept that work? And I think knowing that, and I know some of the those people that are sitting behind me right now, knowing that, it's in their best interest to come forward with recommendations that we can live with. I mean, that's our charter, is that at the end of the day, we are going to be the ones proposing the legislation.
Senator Roebling, I see at least, I haven't added them all up yet, but at least six public members are mentioned without regard to being advocates for one program or the other, although they are they would either be a school district superintendent or coordinator or a school board member. And I don't think you can assume a particular bias one way or the other from those appointments.
Well, Madam Chair, the schools that receive this aid won't want to lose it. And coordinators of programs, you know, they want to keep their programs going usually. So those are some of my concerns.
Shouldn't have to justify it, though? In this kind of setting, and I think that's one of the things that's frank and open discussion about this aid is what it looks like to me is being proposed. Right?
Yep.
Any further discussion? Senator Sieben? Senator Sieben moves that Senate file 3002 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Rules. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Sieben, Senator Bob as well. Okay. Who's here?
Sparks.
Senator Stump, are you present? There he is. Senator Stump brings us Senate file 38, and we have the first engrossment. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
An amendment, but do you want us to consider? But first of all, if you would just give us maybe a 30-second description of the bill and then point out, and we can use our counsel as well, those portions of the bill that are in the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3028 is a department proposal, the governor's one of the governor's education proposals, and we have someone from the department that can probably make a quick run through there. There is our several rulemaking provisions in the bill, and that's why we're here with this legislation. And I believe in visiting with you, Madam Chair, earlier, there was one provision that I think you felt whether it was possible to meet the deadlines for that rulemaking, and hopefully the department will be able to address that.
Okay, first of all, let's just identify those sections of the bill where we have jurisdiction. Mr. Bonner, have you noted those so the members can just look briefly at them?
Madam Chair and members, beginning in Article 2 on page 11, Section 2, and you'll see the actual requirement on page 12, contains a rulemaking requirement. And then at the top of page 13, Section 3 also requires rulemaking. I believe those are both done under the ordinary and customary rulemaking procedures. And then on page 27, there is additional rulemaking authority for the English language proficiency standards.
So there are those three sections.
That's correct.
And Senator Stump, we looked at the language of the first two and would have an amendment that is more appropriate language that's used with regard to rulemaking. And Senator Sieben would move the A2 amendment. We usually, do you have a copy of it?
Oh, Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Madam Chair.
Just a second. Senator Pavos?
I was going to say something while it was being delivered to him.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll wait.
Okay.
That's all right.
So we usually don't say engage in rulemaking. We say adopt rules. And on page 27, we don't say consistent with. We say under. So Senator Seaman moves those technical amendments to your bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The issue with regard to page 27, but then Senator Pappas, did you want to speak before that?
I did, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Stump, it looks like what you're doing is requiring the test, I can't remember what we called it, that teachers have to take the test before you start teacher training instead of after you start teacher training, and then you can't pass the test and you can't be a teacher. So I think this is an excellent idea. I've seen this recommendation around several places, and I think this will be part of what we need to do to improve the quality of people going into teacher education and making sure that what we really want is people who really want to be teachers. And I'm hoping with some of the Gates reform proposals that students who want to be teachers will get more of an opportunity to be in the classroom early on to also gauge whether they think that it's the right fit for them. So this is really good to see.
Senator Stump also pointed out to me earlier today that the language in the beginning of the bill that talks about, that deletes language that says successfully completes an exam and instead is changed to pass an exam,
right,
that some teachers had pointed out that you could successfully complete the exam and still fail it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I want to make sure that people are passing this. They may not even complete it, but they could pass it maybe without even completing it. But just completing it is not good enough. So with regard to the timetable of getting these standards coming about from the rulemaking process ready for 2011-2012, I would assume that they are not non-controversial and that a 14-month time period to get them in place, probably even less than that if you really wanted to do it before the school year began, is a pretty fast pace. So what is your response to that? And if you'd identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Barnage, and I am with the Department of Education. Title III of No Child Left Behind does require that states have English language proficiency standards, and the department has worked with a consortium of school districts and other people in the state since I think about 2003, and some school districts have actually already adopted some national standards. So what the department would be proposing is to also align with our standards with the national standards so that we feel that it would be a fairly quick process.
So Ms. Barnett, you believe it would not be controversial and that even though there are definite timelines for comment periods and et cetera, that the department could accomplish the rules and have them in place in less than a year?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair.
Issue. Is there any discussion on those three rulemaking provisions in the bill? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak to this?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just have a quick question, and it isn't on rulemaking, but it is a rule. If we have the length of the school year and we're changing it for the charter schools so that if they don't have the standard length of hours or the number of hours, that they could lose some state aid. And I know I was thinking about this because some charter schools, for example, will only have a half a day of school, and then they put students in internships in various businesses or something. So I don't know if they could always meet the in-classroom time. Does out-of-classroom time count for those students, or how would we address that?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Barnage?
Senator Roebling, I had not asked this question before, but I can ask Melcher back at the department to clarify that for us. I do know that part of the reason for the change is because a lot of charter schools, the current language is a date before they actually existed. So it could be a change for some charter schools who the law doesn't actually apply to them yet because of that kind of conflict. But I can go back and ask that question for you and clarify that.
You know, I would appreciate that.
Sure.
Senator Stumpf, although the jurisdiction of our committee is rulemaking, we notice that there are all kinds of cuts in this bill, and some of us are uncomfortable with that. This is not the committee of jurisdiction, and so I'm going to entertain a motion to pass the bill without recommendation back to the Finance Committee.
Madam Chair, just maybe a point of clarification.
Okay.
Many of the reductions that you see are actually updating of the forecast when you take in the new February forecast, so it does make automatic reductions to many of the programs.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, but the
sure.
issue is still before us.
I'll move it without recommendation. Madam
Thank
Chair.
You, Senator Betzel. Senator Betzel moves that Senate file 3028 be referred to the Committee on Finance without recommendation. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Appreciate your courtesy with regard to our discomfort. Senator Sparks. Senator Sparks brings us an issue having to do with our county. Senator Sparks, Senate File 2967, and if the committee acts favorably on this bill, it would go to the floor. Senator Sparks.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify in front of you on Senate File 2967 that deals with Mulder County's Office of Recorder appointment provisions. We do have a resolution that was passed by the County Board. I don't know if maybe a page could hand it out. It might be in your files. In the essence of time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Oscarson, the coordinator of Mulder County, to talk a little bit about our proposal this afternoon.
Senator Sparks, did you give copies of it to
yeah.
our committee?
Yeah.
Okay, it's in the packet, members. Okay, I didn't look for it. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Craig Oscarson. I'm the Mulder County Coordinator. I would like to thank the committee and especially Senator Sparks for introducing this bill on behalf of the Mulder County. This is an initiative of the Mulder County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here to speak on their behalf. We believe it's a public input opportunity for us. We're not asking for anything different than what other counties have got in the past, and that's individual county approval on an appointment bill, in this case for the county recorder. We have an opportunity. In our case, our county recorder is retiring after a long and a well-deserved career with the county. And the current statute, for example, it doesn't set any minimum requirements. We're concerned. In a county of our size, this is a highly technical position. It's a specialized position. And in our county, for example, we have 2.5 employees in that office. So one of the things that we're concerned about is, as it's a technical position, we're looking for appointment authority, and the bill does not have any differences from other bills in the past. Still requires public hearing, still requires publication, and possible reverse referendum. Our current recorder, as I said, is retiring. She has taken the position that she's neutral on this bill. She believes this is an issue between the county board and the public, if any issue exists. One of the areas that we may see some budget reductions in the future, we understand with the state budget crisis, we understand counties will end up at some point getting some reductions. Hopefully they're not as large as what the governor's budget is, but we will see some. When we do see some in our offices, we're going to have to look at everything we can. One of the areas we believe in our property tax division is going to have to look at some cross-training of employees, because we will probably see some employee reductions, hopefully through attrition. With that cross-training, we think that we're going to see some service reductions, but not significant. We're also going to be able to see some sharing of staff among offices. In the end, we're going to see some budget reductions. In a county our size, anything can help. As I said earlier, this is an initiative of the Moore County Board. It's also an initiative that's been supported in the past by the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's an individual county bill, not a statewide bill. We would ask for your support in that bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Okay. Mr. McGowan, how many counties have we given the authority to appoint their recorder? How many of them?
Madam Chair, I think we were up in the 50s a few years ago for various offices, not just the recorder, but the treasurer, the auditor, and various combinations, making them combined, elective, appointive.
Okay.
The total of about 50, though, I think, altogether.
Fairly, as you've mentioned, a fairly common thing, but if you look at the summary that Mr. McGowan did, you can see that twice they've tried to do statewide permissive authority and hadn't gotten anywhere. Vetoed once, actually, by Governor Arne, A-R-N-E.
You're right. I didn't notice.
And then on another occasion, it died on the floor. Senator Thickerman.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Pappas, myself, been working with this for the last 20 years, it seems like. I think it should be anybody who wants to do it, but if you want your bill to pass, you may have to go back and just stick with any, instead of statewide.
Yep.
I think safer would be to keep it where it is, because otherwise you're losing on the floor like Senator Kubley did last year. That would be my choice. Not that it's right.
Any other discussion? Senator Roebling and then Gerlach.
Thank you. And I have no objection to this. My counties have done this before. But I'm just curious, when we go from elected officials to professionally appointed officials, is there a change in pay? Do we see it go up, or does it typically start at about the same level? Do you have any idea? Have you investigated that at all?
Generally, it starts at about the same level. Most counties do what we do when we consider elected officials' salaries every year. One of the things that we look at in our county, and is pretty common in other counties, in addition to their performance, we look at our pay equity system. And as you all know what pay equity is, so we have comparisons within our county to other comparable department heads, so the pay should not be affected negatively.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Somebody's got to offer up some opposition.
Yes.
I'll do that. Senator Sparks, I've generally opposed these. Actually, the first time I saw a few of these many years ago, I didn't think much of it, and then I started to think about it, and then I thought really what we're doing is consistently eroding the public's accountability here. We're taking things away from elections and moving to appointed, and I get some of the reasons, but on principle, I've opposed these, and Speaking specifically to the resolution, it says that this is appointing is a more efficient local model. That's the wording on the resolution on the first whereas. And I would ask the question, a more efficient local model as opposed to what? I assume, you don't have to, I mean, that's more rhetorical. I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's referring to as opposed to an election. I assume that appointing is a more efficient local model than an election. Is that your interpretation of it, Senator Sparks?
Do you not go ahead?
Or Mr. Oskerson?
Yeah, well,
you're more familiar with the resolution.
This is a Maurer County Board resolution, not Senator Sparks, so I'll answer that if I could. What we're talking about is a more efficient model, is it gives counties opportunities to put in specific requirements in hiring a position, where in the current legislation, if it's elected, the requirements is they're 18 years old and have $50. And so we can do some efficiencies by requiring certain standards, and we think we can get more efficiency out of that. And then what we can also do as we look at appointments, we can also actually structurally internally build some of these cross trainings and efficiencies among departments, such as the assessor's office with their line staff.
Okay.
That's where we're talking about efficiency.
Madam Chair, and I understand all that, but it's not entirely true. It's not just 18 years old and $50. It's 18 years old, $50, and win an election.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's that. We don't want to downplay that. But I've always thought that these are elections are in democracy are important things to defend, and just on principle. From a high altitude, we eliminate elected positions in the name of efficiency. We change to appointed ones. This job now becomes a bureaucratic one, an appointed civil servant job, as opposed to an elected public official. And I think what we need more accountability. I think elections are good things, and I just don't like to see us get away from that. So that's why I usually argue against these, and I've been on the losing side of that. So I think your bill is going to pass today, but I'll be voting no. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2967? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 2967 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Senator Olson. Senator Olson brings us Senate File 3013.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3013 was brought to me by the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council. There's a request for a very straightforward and small change in the makeup of representation, and I will turn it over to Mr. Edmond to explain more specifically the request.
Madam Chair, my name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. This is a very simple technical amendment to the statutes for Explore Minnesota Tourism. Explore Minnesota Tourism was created in 2004 to provide guidance to Explore Minnesota Tourism and various marketing activities. The council consists of 28 people representing various aspects of the tourism industry. At the time the council was created, we had four regions, tourism regions in the state, and following a long process of discussions with the tourism industry, the regions was reorganized into five, and so very simply the language in this bill removes the reference to the number of tourism regions, but still leaves the category of regional representation, thus eliminating the need for us to come back in front of you at any other future dates to change our statutes when any of the regions change. The bill maintains the reference to 28 voting members.
Are there questions for Senator Olson or her testifier? Well, Senator Betzel.
I'm trying to do the math. I mean, it says 28 voting members, and it says up to 28 voting members. So if there are more people on it than these representatives, how do they decide who gets the vote and who doesn't? I'm trying to quickly count up the number of people we've had, because the four tourism marketing regions would have been four. So So it's possible you may have more than 28. Is that possible? But then only 28 could be voting members?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that the number adds up to about 26. There are two just sort of vacant positions for catch-all in case there's some category that's discovered later on that's missing. I don't have the exact number, and I would have to do the math, but I think that was the reason there's a little bit of wiggle room in there.
Well, but Madam Chair, as I count it up, I get 28 if you count the one director, the 11 representatives, currently four members of tourism, six representatives, the business groups, one, it says one or more ex officio non-voting, four legislators, and then other persons as designated. But that number seems to come to 28. So, again, if you expand this to five tourism, how do you decide which of these people are going to be the 28 voting members?
Mr. Edmund.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that you referenced the director as one of your 28. The director is my capacity, and I don't actually consider myself a member of the advisory committee. The committee is the 28 people giving advice to the agency on various activities. So if you took them out of the equation, that would be 27. And this with a fifth region, that would make 28, as I understand it.
Senator Betzel.
Well, and again, if you somehow expand it, you said that you might go to more tourism regions, and then you wouldn't have to come back. Well, again, you're locked into a number here that, the law doesn't say what the director is or is not voting. It just indicates some positions here. I'm just suggesting to you, if you're, you've got these positions, and at some point you may have to come back and figure out, which of these get to vote and which don't. And, I think you need to figure that out.
Senator
doesn't
Olson.
Matter to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I guess I'm just wondering if you feel it would be a wise suggestion just to allow a little more leeway to change the 28 to 30. I still think, I don't know, as I was adding up the numbers, it seemed like there was still a little bit of room for, that there was still one short, I think. But to avoid a future problem, that would be my suggestion if you're thinking of, if that's your suggestion, or I guess if that was the direction you were thinking of heading.
Senator Betzel.
Well, I'm trying to add them up again. It looks like there might be, it looks like 26.
Right.
And then other persons appointed by the governor. I'm happy to let it go. I just figure that at some point you're going to run into a math problem here. So.
Senator Olson. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, if Senator Betzel doesn't feel the need to address it this at this time, I think we've still got one person leeway, even with that extra person. But I do think that if it becomes necessary in the future, there will have to be a change to add another member or two, or else just designate that certain of these people are not going to be voting members. But for now, I think it's still okay the way it is.
Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 3013? Seeing no one, Senator Betzold?
Yeah, I'll move it.
Moves that Senate File 3013 be recommended to pass. Recommended to pass.
Can I just ask a question quick?
Senator Roebling?
How do you decide when a new tourism region develops?
Mr. Edmund?
Madam Chair, Senator, basically this was brought to us, first of all, based on some research that was done by a third party from another state to look at the various regions of the state and what resonates best with consumers and how to market the state. Then there was extensive discussions going on with the tourism industry, more meetings than perhaps we have time to talk about here all throughout the state, trying to come up with the defined boundaries. And it was the consensus of the tourism industry that we needed to establish five tourism regions to best market the state and also to reflect how they are organized as industry groups. And those five regions are Southern Minnesota, the Metro Tourism Area, Central Minnesota, Northwest, and Northeast. And it was the consensus of a lot of discussion with a lot of industry groups, as well as responding to the consumer direction on how best to organize and to market the state. That's how we came up with the five.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate file 3013 be recommended to pass. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Olson. Senator Betzel brings us Senate file 2918. And I believe there is an amendment. Senator Betzel, is that correct? There's more than one amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, yes. This is the omnibus pensions bill. And the amendment, the 1A amendment, is actually the bill that is prepared by the Pensions Commission. And it is to be amended here because the bill that was introduced is just one of the pension bills, but it's the vehicle bill.
So this is an author's amendment, and then we have a second author's amendment to the delete all amendment. So we'll adopt those forthwith. Senator Betzel moves adoption of the 1A amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel moves the...
It's a reviser's amendment to
clean amendment.
Up a bill. A10-2334.
2334. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the delete all amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel.
And Madam Chair, as I indicated, this is the omnibus pensions bill. The pensions
members
commission
do have, a summary in the bill that I'm imagining that Senator Betzel will direct us to, and if we act favorably on the bill, it goes to the Finance Committee.
Thank
Senator
you, Madam
Betzel.
Chair. The Pensions Commission met regularly over the interim starting last June and all the way until the first week of March to prepare the omnibus bill. You've already seen two parts of this bill that's actually incorporated in here. We saw the MRF bill and then the stabilization bill affecting TRA, MSRS, PERA, Duluth teachers, and St. Paul teachers. Those bills were simply spun out as separate bills only because, given the twists and turns of the legislative session, you don't always know, where you want to keep your bills, but you don't want everything in one basket. Those bills, however, are incorporated in here. I won't spend any time talking about them because we already had hearings on them. The rest of the bill deals with the more regular pension policies that were adopted here, and I'll kind of walk through. Section 1, or Article 1, actually, were the MSRS, PERA, TRA issues that we talked about last week. So I don't need to, I believe, go through those all over again. Article 2 deals with some administrative provisions dealing with the Minnesota State Retirement System. Again, most of these are rather technical. They're dealing with the wrong, if a person's wrongfully discharged, they're defining what a seasonal employee is because in the past that has pension ramifications. It's only been the Department of Revenue that applied to this, applies, more to all other agencies. It addresses some errors and contributions. One of the things that does in this, and that's in Article 2, Article 3 is just information that's been provided to administrators of the third-party administrators who run the programs, the personal and information they're supposed to be getting. Article 4 actually is something that you should pay close attention to because this does affect legislators' pensions. And we spent quite a bit of time on the issue of the fact that there are a number of people in what are called the unclassified service. These are people that generally are in jobs that are not expected to be, they're not expected to be in there long term. You can think of most of the employees here at the legislature. We have very few people that ever retire out of here. We have a lot of people that pass through and they hold jobs for a couple of years, but then they move on. And the reason why they're in this so-called unclassified program is because it's designed for that kind of a job that is not going to be a necessarily long term. We certainly have people that serve a long time, but relatively few when you consider all the people. And those are defined contribution plans where they it's like a 401k. They put their money in, and at some point they're going to move on. They're not going to get enough money for most of them to retire off of, but it is something building towards their retirement. The problem that we've got is the fact that there's a little glitch in the law, and the glitch is the fact that for these unclassified employees,
if they are on a long-term track and they serve a number of years, after 10 years, they can make a choice of whether they want to stay in the defined contribution plan or switch over into a defined benefit plan, the High Five program. But they don't have to make the decision at 10 years. They can wait until the day before they retire and basically choose which one's the better plan for them. And it messes things up for the pension plan trying to figure out, you know, how much they need to book, because they can choose one or the other plan right before they retire. We spent a bit of time in the Pension Commission. We couldn't quite figure out how to deal with the people that currently have that option. And to change it and take it away sometimes becomes very problematic from a legal standpoint. But what we did was we said, and for employees, for future employees, that is those who start after June 30th, 2010, they will basically have the first 7 years to decide which plan they want to be in. If they want to stay in the defined contribution plan, they can do so. If they make a choice for whatever reason to go to the defined benefit plan, they may do so, but they've only got the first 7 years to do that.
Is that irrevocable then, when they make that choice?
Once they make the decision, that's it. And that's the way it is with most pension issues. You make a decision and you live with it, as opposed to waiting until the very end to do that. Now, we have the twist that we have for legislators is the fact that when the law was changed in 1997, legislators elected through 1996 were in an older legislative plan. It was a defined benefit plan. You know, it's dependent your years of service, and every year of service you get some contributions, some credit for that. Well, that was changed so that legislators elected from 1997 forward are in this unclassified defined contribution plan. Now, the one thing that legislators do not have is the fact that they don't get the choice at any time later on to choose whether they want to be in the defined benefit plan or defined contribution. They can't wait. They can't get it at all under the 97 law. They have to remain in the unclassified plan. There have been people that have, you know, questioned that, said, did you know, there, you know, shouldn't we have the opportunity? Well, again, if it's bad policy to let you just go until the very end. But what this bill would do is to say that for legislators that were elected from 1997 forward, and future legislators, you've got a certain time period to make a decision. If you want to stay in the unclassified plan, you can do that. If you want to go in the defined benefit plan, you may do so. But it's not going to be open-ended. You've only got, for legislators currently in the system, they've got until, July 1st of 2011 to make a choice. Future legislators will have up to 7 years to make a choice which one they want to be in. And frankly, it could go either way. I mean, if the stock market is doing very well, you probably want to be in the defined contribution plan. You know, for somebody like me, just for disclosure, I made the choice, even though I was elected before 97, I made the choice to switch over into the unclassified plan. So that's the one I'm in right now. But for somebody, I've been here for now 18 years, High Five isn't really a very good situation for me because I've basically had one pay raise in 5 years. So the defined benefit really, you know, can work or it cannot work. It depends. For some people, if they happen to have a number of years of legislative service, and then later on they might be able to get a commissioner position or something, they might be able to combine their legislative years with the commissioner years and get, you know, a fairly decent pension out of that. One example that I've used, Senator Neville was a very good friend of mine, and when he became a judge, he hadn't paid any attention to what the pension ramifications were. It just so happened that when he qualifies for a judicial pension, the years that he served in the legislature can roll over and apply to those years as a judge almost as though he'd been a judge since 1991. Now, he didn't design it that way. He didn't plan it that way. But he's just one example of many people that have. So there can be a windfall to some people, but most people it would not be. But I'm just calling that to your attention, that there's some issues in here as to why some people would want to be in one plan as to another. The law currently does not allow legislators elected since 1997 to have any opportunity to go on the defined benefit plan. I don't think it's fair to just say let them wait until they get that commissioner position. As I say, if you want to take a risk and a gamble early on, you know, I think we can do it, but this is not going to be open-ended, and that's the way this particular bill is constructed. This could wind up being controversial, as some people wish to make it controversial, because pension issues and legislators are not very well understood by the public. In 1978, a big campaign issue was made right before the elections that when they changed the legislative plan over, that legislators could serve 6 years and get a lifetime pension. Technically true, but very misleading. I mean, if you only serve 6 years in the legislature, you could qualify for a pension, but not much of a pension. So it might be an easy issue to demagogue, and might be an issue to raise, but, you know, and I'm just calling it to your attention that this is the proposal, and we spent, again, a lot of time in the Pension Commission trying to come up with something that was fair and equitable, but something that could not be abused in the process. But that's Article 4 dealing with, you know, that issue and a couple of other related issues there.
Senator Betzel?
Yes.
For those who were, did you say that if you were a legislator prior to the 97 law and you were on the defined benefit plan, it was at that point that you could choose? And if you chose to stay with the defined benefit plan, that was an irrevocable decision as well?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
When did we make the change? Because legislators at some point were not subject to Social Security. When did we make the change that Social Security is now part of the compensation package? And what happened to people who were not paying Social Security prior to the law change?
I'd have to defer to Mr. Martin on that. That was a few years ago. That was something Senator Skoglund pressed, because there were legislators that were not paying into Social Security and therefore, you know, did not have that benefit. But, Mr. Bergstrom, I think, can answer that question.
Bergstrom, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, when was the Social Security change made?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I don't remember the exact year. I'm thinking it was 5, 6, 7 years ago. I think we actually allowed two referendums at different times. And what it did, it allowed legislators to elect to be covered by Social Security. And the primary reason for that is that Social Security does apply a penalty to people who do not have sufficient quarters of Social Security and have a pension plan that does not get covered. Like the legislator's plan, you don't pay into Social Security, so your Social Security could be reduced because of that. So we did have a referendum in, and I'm thinking 6, 7 years ago.
So, Mr. Bergstrom, now are all new legislators covered by Social Security? Do they pay into it?
Madam Chair, yes. Since 1997, when they went as part of going into the unclassified plan, that plan is coordinated with Social Security, so they have both Social Security and the unclassified plan service.
And wasn't it the case when we made that switch over that you could elect to pay the employer's share of the Social Security as well as your own share?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The group that elected to pay that Social Security had to pay both pieces because there was concern about the additional cost to the legislature at the point. So it was fairly expensive for those people that did choose during that referendum period choose to be covered by Social Security because they're paying essentially both pieces of that.
I want to make that clear to people. It's very expensive. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, are the changes that I made for St. Paul teachers on your other bill, are those incorporated into this bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Again, we adopted the stabilization bills that we heard last week, and the A10-2334, yeah, I believe that included the St. No, it did not include the St. Paul teachers, so we're going to have to... We'll have to do that in finance. So that, because that was an additional amendment.
We had another amendment on the other bill we had to do in finance.
Right, yeah. We'll have to pick that one up in finance. So yeah. This is only the ones that we came in with last week. So right. We did not pick that one up, but we'll have to make sure that's there. Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, continuing on, Article 5 deals with PERA and their administrative provisions. And again, these are, you know, more in-house and more technical about fines for employers who fail to report properly, employees dealing with county elected sheriffs being included in the plan. We've added, there are some hospitals that were public and have become privatized. We had a system for allowing the employers to continue on in the plan, even though that the hospital has been going from public to private. We've been dealing with the city of Duluth and for some overpayment on pension matters that we were dealing with a year ago, and this did some corrections in there. Calculating overtime salary used in computing pensions. Again, a lot of it's quite technical, but quite important in PERA. Article 6 deals with lump sum for volunteer firefighters. This is an issue that the state auditor has been working on, and the voluntary, and basically, instead of having just one level of payment for lump sums, we've got five different levels here. Article 7 is dealing with Teachers Retirement Association. For many years, the way the teachers' credits have been served is the number of hours that they work during the week, and the number of hours is translated, you know, into ultimately how much credit. So this has been changed to salary, and it's not without a bit of discussion that we had with it, because you can get two different teachers in two different districts teaching the same subject, teaching the same grade, but one's paid more than the other. And of course, if you base their pension on their salary, you know, one might be in a better position than the other. However, it's also difficult to try to compute the number of hours worked unless you know, it just became unmanageable. So starting on June 30th of
2012,
it's an error in here. It should be June 30th of 2012 is when we're going to switch over to have it being based upon the teacher's credit for their pensions based upon
that's
hours.
It's correct
salary.
In the language of the bill, is that right?
It's correct in the language of the
summary.
Bill. It's the summary that says error. 2010, okay. And the summary should say 2012.
Madam Chair, I'm really confused by this one.
Okay.
Senator Roebling, you are not alone.
Madam Chair and
Senator Roebling.
Senator Vetzelder, Mr. Martin. Typically, we have a percent of each person's salary contributing to the pension fund, and then the employer contributes likewise whatever their assigned portion is. How on earth is this going to work if we're basing it on hours worked? How are we going to have a formula for that?
It's currently based on hours worked. This switches it over to salary. And is Ms. Hacking, if she's here, I need, or somebody from TRA to come forward, because, again, this was their proposal, and they just felt that it was easier to compute it if it was based on salary, not on hours worked.
Which it is currently.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, there's two issues here. One
you
is
would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, Luther Thompson.
Mr.
From
Thompson.
TRA. There are two issues here. Yes, you're absolutely right. Contributions are based upon salary, and it's the salary that determines, you know, if you're in high five, what salary you get. The other issue is service credit. How much service credit do you get for a year? Now, you have to work 170 days to get a full year of service credit. But it's based upon, and there's an hourly issue, that you have to have at least 5 hours a day in order to get credit for a full day. And so it can vary. You have inconsistencies now. You can have a teacher working 5 half-days or one working 3 days of 5 hours a day, and the one that's working 3 days at 5 hours gets more service credit than the other one. So we're trying to correct that. Not only that, the schools found it extremely difficult to keep track of the hours. So this is a more efficient way of trying to determine service credit. And it doesn't, you have to separate the service credit and the salary that a person pays their contributions on.
Okay, Madam Chair.
General,
it sounds like a good switch to me, but But then are we still going to try and have identical pensions for people who have worked in identical positions in different districts, or we're just saying that's not going to be important? It's based on your salary.
Yes, Madam Thompson. Chair, Senator Roebling, it's no different than now. If your salary in outstate Minnesota is lower than your salary in, perhaps an urban school, when you retire, your retirement is based upon the number of years you have served and your high five salary. So if you could have two teachers that taught the exact same subject and taught in two different schools, and they could end up with different pensions because their high five salaries would be different. But they would have the same, they could have put in the same number of hours, and their service credit would have been identical. They'd had maybe 30 years of service credit, but one could have certainly had a higher salary, and their pension would be higher because of that.
Senator Betzel, do these provisions, making this change, have a fiscal impact?
Madam Chair, no, this is cost neutral.
Cost neutral, okay.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
I guess that in the regular world, there is no complete parity either, and so I can understand that this is going to be similar. And it just is the way it is. Somebody once said the only fair in Minnesota is the one that happens from the middle of August to Labor Day. And, we just have to deal with the rest.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Article 8 is dealing with the Minsky system. Their employees have the opportunity to have what's called the individual retirement account. It's kind of like a 401k type of investment. But rather than having the investments decided by the State Board of Investments, they wanted the opportunity to, look at other vendors beside the State Board of Investments to do that. That's what basically what Article 8 does. Article 9 is more of a pensions commission issue. We put some deadlines in there when the funds are to get their actuarial reports to our staff and their experience and studies. Just to make sure that we get them on time so that we can, start preparing our pension issues as the bill's going there. Article 10 actually deals with a law that's expired last July that we had on the books for early retirement incentives. And again, this was an issue that dealt with people that, people in higher paid positions that you wanted to probably would be interested in taking some early retirement so that the cost of the state, the agencies, would be lessened. Obviously, by taking an early retirement, if they started on their pension, they'd be getting less of a pension that they worked on. But since the program expired and this is being extended to August 1st of 2012, Article 11 deals with an issue that's come up with some frequency in the Pension Commission where you get people that go through a divorce proceeding. And they've made their dissolutions based upon the marital assets, but one of the assets that they have is the pension. And, of course, once they've made that pension decision to share the pension, well, if they're dividing the assets, it might be more equitable. If the court decides it's more equitable to let one of the parties keep the pension, then you got to back up and get special legislation to try to change all that. This basically says that if the court so orders that you can go back and change the pension decision. If the court orders that as part of the division of the assets, then this can be allowed there instead of having all these people come to us and try to get a special law because of how the divorce went about and how their divorce decree came about. In number 12, this is 12 and 13 deals with the MRF issue, and that's one we already brought before you. And that bill is already in the Finance Committee. This is the same issue here. Article 14 is Voluntary Firefighters Relief Association. And this is one I get the state auditor was working on. Some technical changes in there. Article 15 deals with one person or small group issues. We get those every year, and basically there was only one that we approved this year. This was somebody who was hired by the school district in Inver Grove Heights but was not properly reported to them, and it was no fault of the employees, so the school district has to pay the contributions that would have been made, and the employer can obviously get the credit that the employee should have had if the employee had been properly reported. And then the Article 16 is miscellaneous positions. The Hennepin County Medical Center is listed as is referred to in the there's exclusions from prohibiting new or creation of new government plans, and the reason why this was done was because they were spun off.
Members, I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission. A few years ago, Hennepin County Medical Center was given special authority to create some particular plans for just the medical center. There was a reference to the as an exception to the prohibition on creation of new public pension plans in the Hennepin County Medical Center statutes, but not in the general prohibition statute. So this adds the necessary cross-reference so there's less confusion.
Yeah, we don't want more pension plans being created, but this was already done before, so just we want to make sure that exception was recognized.
Okay, are there questions for Senator Betzel or Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, if there, and I don't know if there's anybody else is here on this bill, so if there are no other questions, then I'll move the Senate File 2918 as amended, be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
You've heard Senator Betzel's motion. Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask, I'm still trying to figure out, and I'm sure they will, where the extra $136.7 million, as I have it figured out, a year comes from. But that I just have a question. I'm just wondering, because Senator Betzel is into this. I had a constituent ask me the other day, why is it the state couldn't take the approach as private business does and say, offer all the state employees the opportunity to join a 401k plan, and the state would say something like they do in the private sector, employee, you can invest up to 10%, and the employer, being the state and the citizens of the state, will match you up to 3%. And their question was, wouldn't this be a more simple way to handle pensions for all state employees, and one would be able to then realize what it would cost the citizens to participate in that as on the employer side?
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, the unclassified plan, the defined contribution plan, essentially does that. And as I say, that's where the employee contributes money, and so does the employer. They both contribute, into a investment. And then and that's why, again, for the unclassified employees, that works out better for them. But we do have that already for certain employees. For current employees, I don't know that legally we can force them out of the plan that they're already in and force them into something else. It would also, for now going forward in the future, I don't know that it's not easy for the plans to mix and match. You either got to have one plan or another. You can't have within all of the state employees having some say, I want to go, define this way and some that within. I mean, it just caused a nightmare, within the various plans. What could be done, and this would cause significant problems down the road, is basically close out some of the current plans and say all new employees, all future employees would have to go, say, the defined contribution plan. The problem that you're going to get there is that at some point down the road when you close out a plan, you're not going to have any more employer or employee contributions coming in, which is what we've seen in MRF. You're going to have basically only retirees, and if the money isn't there to fund the plan, the plan could go broke. And so it's a vexing thing. I mean, it's been discussed, trying to figure out what's the better way to go forward. A lot of people have been talking about it, trying to come up with a better idea. I don't know that we quite have the answers there yet. You are correct that as far as a pure planning for pensions, defined contribution, makes it a lot easier than defined benefit. but then it's all tied up in the investments. If we had put everybody in the, you know, all government employees in defined contribution plans, they'd be rioting out there in the front of the Capitol right now, you know, because of the stock market, crashing the way it's been. It's going to bounce back, but there's pluses and minuses for both defined contribution and defined benefits. With defined contributions, you're locked in, with defined benefit, you're locked into your high five. But if you have long periods of inflation, that high five is just going to be eaten up, and you're going to fall further and further behind in cost of living. So it isn't really simple that one way is the best way to go as opposed to the other. There's advantages and disadvantages to both.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I guess the reason I bring that up is because it appears that we are guaranteeing or creating this safety net if for some reason, which as in the past, the plans don't perform because of a downturn in the economy, which we've gone through. And it appears that because you're a state employee, we're asking the rest of the citizens to create this safety net. And, you know, just as what I talked about the other day in MRF, that if a plan doesn't perform to what we think it might, mm-hmm. the citizens in the rest of the state have to kick in more dollars to bring that plan into solvency.
Well, Madam Chair, the whole pension area can get complicated, and you get corrections officers, for example, police officers, firefighters, and these are individuals that put their lives on the line, regularly, and at some point, they can't work any longer doing those jobs. We've promised them that we would basically provide a pension for them at some point, and we can't really renege on that. It isn't just the stock market. That certainly has caused some downturn in the funds, but it's also because of policies that were set by the legislature back in the 90s. It wasn't just pension issues. It was a lot of issues because the economy was white hot, and people were saying, it was never going to end. It was just we were on that track forever. We reduced taxes to the tune of about $4 billion in the states because people said, the proof that we've had these surpluses are proof that we are overtaxed. In the pension area was no different. Because the pension funds were starting to build up surpluses back in the 90s, again, because of the stock market and for various other reasons, we wound up saying, okay, maybe we shouldn't be taking the maybe we don't need the employers and the employees to be contributing as much to the pension plans. Well, it's not just the stock market. Other things have changed. People are living longer. There have been changes within the funds, and we just have to be flexible enough to recognize it. But we make a lot of decisions in the legislative process, but one legislature is not bound by the other. If we decide to put money in one program and cut the money the next next time around, we can do that, and we have done that. Pensions is sort of a unique area because, again, this is more of a promise that was made, not just a funding issue and from one biennium to the next. It's a promise that was made. And people have, in some cases, taken lower-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. People have relied upon the promises that were made. And what is the option if the fund does fail? What choices are there to be? We can sit around and say, well, we don't want to, it's a waste of money to do this and do that, but what do you tell these retirees? How do you deal with that if they become wards of the state, basically? And so, we're trying to do the responsible thing around here and make sure that, that the funds have a long-term stability. The things that I described before, frankly, are not easy on any of the people that are dealing with. It's not easy for retirees. It's not easy on employers and employees. But virtually all of the groups, most of the groups, not all, but, have said, we have to share the pain in here. And it is painful, but, they're willing to do it.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the biggest increases that in contributions that we're going to have to make is to the State Patrol Retirement Plan. And I'm wondering, as I look at this, I see that the member contribution rate is only increasing 0.8%, but the state's contribution is going to go up about 11.2%. And how did we arrive at that balance? Typically, almost all the other funds are much more evenly balanced between the employer and the employee. And this one looks like it's really skewed. So, and I know this is a generous pension that the State Patrol has, and they can get very early retirement, and the benefits are fairly rich when they do retire. So how is it that the employees aren't contributing more to their deficiency?
And Mr. Bergstrom,
we had a beginning discussion of this last week sometime. But
we did talk about it.
But I think it's probably good to refresh our minds about why this kind of catch-up provision.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the employees are increasing their contributions slightly, and then the concept behind the public safety plans is that the employees pay 40% generally, and the employer pays 60%. The reason that we are moving away from that and asking the employers to pay more is somewhat related to the large relationship of the retiree liabilities in a state patrol plan, where you have active employees paying in for a relatively short time from, let's say, age 25 to 55, because that's their full retirement age, and then their retirement period goes from 55 to 81 or 86 or whatever on average. So they have a relatively small period of employment, short period of employment, and a longer period of retirement. When the stock market dropped, because a lot of those liabilities were in the retiree side, it didn't seem fair to have the actives pick up the total cost because of the drop in the retiree liability. It just, you know, we would have to raise contribution rates to a very unacceptable level. And so at this point, in a plan that has always been very well funded, has been over 110% funded at some point, it got hit extremely hard by the drop in the stock market, harder than the rest of the programs. And I would like to say that when we are looking at this bill in totality, the liabilities being paid into MSRS are being cut in the neighborhood of $70 million, where we're asking for a total contribution of $7 million. So most of what we're achieving in this bill is balancing and making sure we have enough to pay through liability cuts. The only exception to that is the State Patrol plan that just got hit harder by the market because of the higher liability for their retiree group.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
It makes the proposal that the counties put out about reducing the State Patrol and letting county sheriffs and local police handle a little more of the patrol duties seem a little more appealing. The other question I have is that money going to be coming out of the Trunk Highway Fund?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, most of the money would be coming out of the Trunk Highway Fund. And I do have a meeting tomorrow with the departments and MMB to see what kind of piece we can put together. We clearly don't expect to pass all of this year, and we are going to meet tomorrow to see what's an acceptable solution for that.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Anyone in the audience wish to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate file 2918 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Clark.
I don't know where I'm at.
They're doing some good things.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Clark brings us Senate file 3005. Farrakhan.
And Madam Chair, there is an A1 amendment.
Senator Clark has the A1 amendment, is that correct? This is an author's amendment. Senator Carlson moves adoption of the A1 amendment. It is in your packets. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Clark, tell us about your bill.
Madam Chair and members, I'm very glad to be here today. This actually is an agency bill, but it's something that we've been talking about and working on for a while. It relates to best value procurement. I think you know that currently the Met Council must purchase transit vehicles using the sealed bid process. The method specified under Minnesota Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, and this practice is inconsistent with other government practices. And we believe a best value procurement alternative is currently allowed for purchase of transit vehicles by MnDOT and other state agencies, but not for the Met Council. Allowing for a best value procurement alternative in purchasing public transit rolling stock would provide the Met Council a method to select the most advantageous offer rather than the lowest sealed bid. I believe this is important. We saw this in the last couple years with the buses that were going on with New Flyer, among others. We've been able to utilize this type of a process. I don't know how it would have ended up, but it would have given the Met Council more flexibility. So this particular bill would permit for that process so that they have a better opportunity to have give and take with potential vendors and make the best decision possible. Now, we could talk a little bit more about specifically what it does. Part of what the amendment does, I want you to notice there is an effective date that is retroactive, and that is in part because they're in the process of a procurement that would, this particular process would allow, we believe, for a better bid process.
Mr. Lamb, if
Madam Chair, for the record,
to the committee and identify yourself for the record.
My name is Brian Lamb. I'm the general manager for Metro Transit. And normally on a day like today when we're talking about best value procurement, we're thinking about two for one on Guinness, but we're talking about transit vehicles.
For later on
and,
today.
Madam Chair, Senator Clark's earlier point, we are in the process right now of going through procurement for light rail vehicles for Central Corridor and option vehicles for Hiawatha and potential others. We started this process as we have with other major procurements, thinking that we were going to have a delegated authority that MnDOT has to allow us to purchase these vehicles under the best value procurement authority that MnDOT does have. This is actually an industry accepted and preferred practice, and as a matter of fact, I know specifically that at least a few of the interested vendors are only interested in proposing on this if we proceed with a best value procurement. So we were proceeding last September in through this process with the assumption that we were going to have best value delegated authority. But because this project is not necessarily a MnDOT-led project, and after discussion with MnDOT and the Department of Administration, it was determined that it was really preferable to come back and get this authority for the council. And we would like to be able to have it for all vehicles because, as you know, that we procure quite a few buses as well. So that's one of the reasons why, rather than having to start the process over again, we'd like to pick up with the best value authority effective going back through this September timeframe when we really started the current process.
Okie dokie. Questions or comments for Senator Clark or Mr. Lamb? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that 3005 as amended be recommended to pass. Has it already been to transportation? It doesn't have to go.
You can go to the floor.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
My favorite, best value. I always have this question that I don't understand the need for best value if you write a tight bid specification. So if you know what you want in quality and you know what your delivery schedule needs to be and you know what you want for a warranty, for example, why would you have to bid at best value? Why couldn't you put that into the bid specifications and ask for those specific things? If they can meet them, they can meet them. And if they can't, well, maybe we shouldn't be considering them in the first place. And, you know, it just, best value is just kind of subjective in a lot of ways. And I worry that we're going to end up maybe spending more than we should on some of these purchases that we could have possibly avoided when somebody knows that you're going to take the low bid.
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's a very good question. And let me just say, when you're talking about very complicated technical equipment like vehicles are, one of the things that we have to be mindful of is that the technology is changing all the time. But if you're saying when you write the specs, you know exactly what's out there in terms of the best utilization, most cost-effective way to put together these vehicles. I think in this ever-changing environment, that's kind of the wrong assumption. What best value allows you to do is to kind of work with the industry to solicit ideas that they have about, well, we think we could meet your needs by putting this particular set of, I'll say, technical equipment together. Would you accept that? And what best value allows you to do is to go through an iterative cycle of discussions to, first of all, look at whether the vendors that you're dealing with are credible. And that's always kind of a key component. And if you were strictly looking at, you know, their ability to serve, those kinds of things, in a low bid environment, you don't necessarily have that as a criteria that you can kind of start to screen through. But secondly, once they get through that process, you want to be open enough to say, yes, you have a certain product, and you have a certain product, and we believe they both could serve our needs. So what we're going to do is to say, in the best and final process, that we're going to allow your product to be, you know, as long as it meets these components, and your product as long as it meets these, standards or whatever it is, to be put together in what we'll call a best and final offer. And a best and final offer will say, you give us your best price, but we're also going to consider some of those things that you say, you know, for instance, for us, it's like a stainless steel frame versus a composite frame. There's some benefits to having, one or the both or the other, but we want to be able to evaluate them fairly and evenly.
Madam Chair, if you want a stainless steel frame, put it in the bid specifications. I just think that we can use bid specifications, and I know technology does change, and on something like maybe train cars, it might. I don't know. I do have problems with best value because I think we should be able to know ahead of time pretty much what we want, and ask for that specifically. And I feel uncomfortable with doing it this way.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, you know, I have to admit I kind of thought similarly until we went through the purchasing process on the large bus order that the Met Council had within the, again, a couple years ago. And it was in part because we had a Minnesota-based company that meet their specifications, except for the specifications have been drafted by a particular person that were very specific, very, 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 very specific, as in like only one company could probably meet those needs because that's exactly what this company happened to have done. And I don't think that you'd want it to be so tight that nobody else in a market that has a comparable and good product could actually meet those needs. So that's where I started to be personally concerned. And again, you know, New Flyer happens to be in my area, so I'm very familiar with I've learned a lot from them and then from others about this type of a process. They may have come up forward with a different fuel that could be used that had not been thought of, but then a different company may have a different piece or a subset that might be desirable as well, and it might be not quite apples to apples. But this would allow them to really get a chance to say what would work best for us in these situations instead of, frankly, at times maybe one person who drafts things so that only one company can. So that's where I get concerned. I think this really does give us both the best value for the dollar, but also making sure we've got a product that we can feel is going to be meeting the needs and has gone through a process where really there's more rigor than just writing something, you know, that's off of a specification.
Madam Chair. I actually can think of another example. I had a business in my district that provides like playground sand. And the bid specification from, I think, Minneapolis said they wanted it to be 99.9% wire-free. Well, so they went with the low bid. Well, it turns out that this is maybe one of the few companies in the country that's a local Minnesota company that does 100% wire-free. Now, if you were a parent, wouldn't you rather have 100% wire-free than 99.9%? And I think maybe Minneapolis didn't know that that existed. And had they had a best value method, this company would be able to inform them that we may be, you know, a tenth of a penny more per ton or however they do it, but we're a much safer product, and so we're a better value. So I can see where some kind of a process, I mean, they try to get the word out, but if they had a more open bidding process, they'd be able to present that to the buyer, for example, as an option.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I guess I want to give you a little bit of comfort level also. I've worked a lot on specifications, for equipment that our company bought. And also, at one time, I was involved in a company that sold to the state. And I know that exactly what both Senator Clark and Senator Pappas are saying, that there can be specifications written so that only one vendor can meet them. And if I remember correctly, I think there was an incident that happened sometime in the last maybe 5 or 10 years where the Cirrus company from Duluth sued because they were aced out of a specification for an airplane that was purchased by, I don't know if it was purchased by Minnesota or by another government entity. But what this does is this gives you that ability to put together, in my case it's always a spreadsheet where you can trade off things like delivery schedule, quality, and then the many, many attributes that might be something that you can give here for something better over here. And unless we're going to design totally, for instance, like you mentioned, if we want a stainless steel frame versus a composite frame, if we're going to design entirely, like we design a bridge, design it completely, and then do what's called bid to print, then we could do that. But given the fact that there's a lot of differences that can be can exist in especially a commercially available vehicle like a bus, this is probably the best way to go about it because it gives us the best, again, it's the best value for the price.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
How much does the cost weigh in the bid, then? What percent of
Mr. Lamb
of the points or whatever?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the requirement would be that you would, prior to issuing your initial notice, that you would tell them how you would plan to factor all of the considerations, what the considerations would be, and what percentage of the overall calculation would be. For instance, it wouldn't be uncommon to have cost front-end costs to be at least like 50% of the overall consideration.
Right. It doesn't, you know, so it doesn't give us
that. But Madam Chair? Further discussion, Senator Roebling?
So it changes each time you put a bid out what the points for the cost would be, perhaps? What percent?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that's theoretically correct, is that it could change each time that you would put a procurement out there. And you would look at really the nature of the procurement when you set the individual parameters. For instance, it is a well-seasoned market, meaning are there experienced vendors out there? And if that's known to be yes, then you might de-emphasize prior experience a little bit in your criterion and put up cost as a higher component. Or if it's a rapidly changing technology, you might look at some other kinds of factors, that would depend on the individual procurement that you're working with.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, we have one more bill to go, and it's 60 degrees outside.
I know. I wish that were the right time.
That's not the right time.
I know. It's not I just was wondering if there is anything in law that had a minimum amount of for cost as part of the consideration. I mean, how could you go down to 10%, or what would be a minimum amount? You mentioned 50% might be common. Is 25% not uncommon?
Mr. Lamb?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, no, obviously when we're dealing with taxpayer dollars funding these things, we obviously want to make sure that we ensure the best value or the best bang for the buck. So cost is always going to be, if not the, then one of the top percentage evaluating criteria, if you will. And so while I can't even imagine a scenario where it would only be, let's say, 10 to 25%. It would be always in that at least half kind of range.
Renew my motion.
I'm good. Done. Senator Pappas moves that Senate file 3005 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion
still not convinced.
And getting closer.
Gotta speak louder.
Senator Rust, welcome to the committee again in this capacity for the last bill on the agenda on a 60-degree day, Senate File 2925.
Mr. Chairman, I have a delete all amendment.
Senator Rust, this is the first stop.
That's right.
Senator Rust moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill comes to us from the Metropolitan Council. And it has to deal with the way in which our wastewater treatment systems are paid for. Currently, we have one charge that's paid by current users, and we have a second charge for future users that is billed to the cities through what's called the SAC charge, the service availability charge. Because of the housing crisis, the SAC charges have been decreasing alarmingly, and yet there is still the need for those dollars. The original bill provided that the obligation for the systems were going to be transferred to the current users. In working with the cities, we have arrived at an accommodation where the SAC charges, in a sense, will borrow, future users will borrow from the current users, and then at a time-limited period, I think that the date is 2015, the program is sunset, and the current users who have been, in a sense, loaning the dollars to the future users are going to be paid back by lower fees that will be charged to them. So netting it out, they will have kept the system whole, but they will not be loaning the dollars without a payback. And that's what the delete all amendment does. And we do have people here to answer questions or testify, but as I understand it now, there is
no opposition.
There is no opposition from the affected parties.
Okay, then. Do you have testimony you would like to give, or just questions? Questions from members. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand. So we have to pay off the installation of these trunk lines and things like that, and we don't have people developing, so there's nobody to pay in some instances, or very few, less than expected. So we're making some adjustments. But when we come back and start development up again, will it mean a lot higher SAC charges for those who connect later? Or what am I hearing? I didn't quite follow that.
Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Judd Shedden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Senator Roebling, what has happened right now is, as we gave you a handout, and on page 6 of the handout, it shows how the SAC reserve balance has collapsed. And to answer your question specifically, is it doesn't mean the SAC charges are necessarily going to go up extraordinarily. What we're trying to do here is to keep that from happening, because we have to pay our debt service, and right now the only option we have is to do it through SAC, which would mean potentially doubling the current SAC charge, which we believe, and our other folks believe, could potentially stunt the ability for growth to happen even when we get out of this economic downturn. So what we're trying to do is avoid that. Yes, we expect that SAC is going to take an incremental increase, but we will do that in order to make sure that we don't have to, through this legislation, borrow more money or have the municipal wastewater charge pay for more of the debt service that the SAC charge is supposed to pay. So we're really kind of trying to do a handoff here where both of them take a little bit of the we'll pay a little bit of that debt service. And then what the bill does is that once we've got a two-year reserve in the SAC capacity, we're going to be able to make that transfer back. And that is where we worked with Metro Cities. Patty Nauman's here from AMM to speak about that. We put the sunset on there to make sure that this goes away so it doesn't we don't go back to the municipal wastewater charge. And we want to put this back to where it's supposed to be. But we expected that SAC rates I should have the chart here right in front of me, but it shows the SAC units collected. In 2005, we collected 19,334 units. In 2009, we collected 6,675. We had anticipated, based on our forecasting, that the SAC collections were going to rebound, and they haven't. We found ourselves having to come to the legislature in order to address this. We didn't realize we were going to have to do this until about a week before session started, when our forecasters came back and said, you've got a big problem. So what we have right now is that we don't see that rebounding happening for another at least 2 to 3 years. So we needed to do something to make sure that our ability to pay that debt was put in place. And you also have a handout from Terry Kuhlman at the PFA urging their support of this because our ability to fund our debt service also weighs heavily into the PFA's bond rating. So all of this is kind of tangled up together, but between the cities and the council, we believe we've arrived at the proper approach to handle this hopefully short-term issue. I would also like the council to know that we have a SAC task force that is made up of cities and the council in order to address this in a long-term basis. Like I said, we didn't anticipate having to come back and do this this year because we were going to let our SAC task force make the recommendation. And the fact that things got so bad so quickly, we couldn't let that happen in order to protect our bond rating. So we want the SAC task force to look at the issue over the longer term and come back and make a recommendation of how we avoid these issues in the future. But leave no doubt about it, we have to pay this debt service, and the agreement that we've arrived at, we believe, is the proper way to approach this. So we would appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chetton, on page 7, you have a chart showing how much the rates have gone up from 2005 to 2010. But after that, that's what I'm kind of curious about. So we're at 2100 in 2010. So what will be the proposal in the next couple of years? Will it be a couple hundred onto each of these, or what are we talking about?
Mr. Shutton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm going to defer to Jason Willett. Jason is our financial officer for the Metropolitan Environmental Services, which is our wastewater utility, and he is in charge of this, and he can speak to that.
Mr. Willett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling. For the record, Jason Willett, finance director for MCS. We do set the SAC rates and our other rates annually. So every spring we look at and try to reforecast, and that's actually required by law, 473.517 subdivision 3, that we do that annually and look at it. So we need to go through a process, and we will. We will have meetings with the communities as we do every year to give them a chance to comment on that, and then the council sets the rates usually in the summer. We would probably be looking at $150 or $200 increase, but that won't pay really what SAC's required to pay, and that's what Mr. Shetton was saying. You know, the only lever we have right now under current law, if you don't do anything, because the units have fallen so much, is to raise the SAC rate very high, which could actually stifle growth or push it out of the sewered area. We're trying to avoid that, but for equity's sake, we have assured the cities we'll continue to make at least some increase in SAC every year, that it can't pay its share that it normally would.
Thank you, Mr. Willett. Any further questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves. Senator Rust can move her own bill, 2925, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, we will be meeting on